Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't.
Our guest this week grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, earned a bachelor's degree in economics and an honorary degree in journalism from Simmons College. From 1971 to 86, she was an actress and singer in musical theater. In 1987, she was the first voice on WFAN when it became the first all-sports radio station in the country. Since 2005, she's been the color commentator for the New York Yankees radio broadcasts, and she's the first full-time female color commentator from Major League Baseball. In 2022, she was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame. Her name, Susan Wolman. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a pioneer and a Hall of Famer, Susan Wolman. She's the first full-time female commentator in Major League Baseball history. Susan, welcome. An honor to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Jack. It's an honor for me to be here and be talking to you.
All right. We'll start with your childhood, your parents, and also your grandfather, Herman Dine. Please.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, growing up in Boston, when you grow up in Boston, you there are three things that that you really know about, and that's education, politics, and sports, not necessarily in that order. And my grandfather, who graduated from Harvard in the class of 1916 after coming over on a cattle boat from Russia, had season tickets to Red Sox games, and I started going to Red Sox games when I was three. He used to tell me it was my own season ticket. It belonged to the state, but I thought it was mine. And, you know, you're a little girl, and you walk into what was a little gem, a little jewelry box of a park back then, Fenway Park, and you're 4 years old, and you sit right in front, and you can literally reach out and see Ted Williams and touch him. It stays with you. I've got to admit, I mean, everybody always asks me about sports, but I grew up, I was a tiny little girl in the 50s. There were no women around doing sports. I was always going to sing. I always danced. I always was going to act. I was going to come to New York and be on Broadway, and I was always going to do that. But sports was there because that's what you were brought up with in Boston, and I got to tell you, it's always very interesting when I hear my when people introduce me and I hear all the firsts and firsts. Back then, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to know sports. I mean, my mother knew sports, my aunts knew sports. I always tell a joke, Cardinal Cushing back then used to bring the nuns in Fenway Park. They knew sports. I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to know, and that didn't happen until I left theater and tried to get into this business. But pretty, you know, was there any traumas in my childhood? No. I was just always going to go to New York and be on the stage, and I just loved sports. I just loved baseball. It was something very musical about baseball to me. When I walked in there, it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, like a song, and I just thought the whole thing was magnificent. I felt that way, actually, when my dad took me to my first Celtics game in the 50s, and I learned basketball by listening to Red Auerbach, coach at the time, the greatest five ever on the court, and that's Cousy, Sharman, Russell, Heinsohn, and Ramsey. And it was just a, you know, that was always, it wasn't even a hobby. It was just something I loved and something I got to do, but I was always going to go to New York and be in theater because, you know, girls didn't do that. You know, I didn't see any girls playing sports. I wasn't very good anyway, so it wouldn't have been better I stuck to dancing and singing.
All right. Speaking of actress and singing, from 71 to 86, that was your career, musical theater. Talk about that chapter in your life.
Well, it's interesting, and actually I came to New York in 68 after I graduated from college. See, back then it was a very interesting thing. My mother said, you can do whatever you want when you graduate from college. And I went, okay. And you stayed, and my mother said, I'm going to school, and I went to school. But as soon as I graduated from college, I did a lot of shows in college. I did musicals at Harvard and MIT, and was a special student at the New England Conservatory, and, you know, it was kind of a little terror back then. If you can be a terror in the 60s, you know, I was one of those, because I was going to do something else, and I didn't see why I had to go to class every day. I had other things to do. Simmons College, by the way, where I got my degree, they gave me an honorary doctorate last year, and I, when they called to tell me, I said, are you sure you've got the right person? Simmons College was across the street from, and still is, across the street from Fenway Park. So not only did I sing in shows, I went to the ball game every day. So that was kind of my college career. I was just lucky enough that, you know, I was very good at math, so economics is math, so you don't have to write papers, and you either know it or you don't. So that was my luck. But as soon as I graduated from college, I went to New York. I didn't know anybody, and I started auditioning, went to cattle calls. I think my first job, actually, I got paid $85 a week. I did a summer stock production of Student Prince. I was in the chorus, and it starred an old singer who's no longer with us, John Gary, and that was my, I got my equity card, and my $85 a week I thought was unbelievable. And then I started, you know, once you get your equity card, you can start going to auditions. And I did a lot of things that flopped, and I did, I found one show that I did as well as anybody, and that was Man of La Mancha. I did it off and on for 12 years, and I bought my house with Man of La Mancha. And I did it with every old movie star that came out of Hollywood, Alan Jones, Howard Keel, bunch of the guys. And then I was the final Aldonza Dulcinea opposite Richard Kiley, who was the original. And I'll tell you, Jack, and I think about this a lot, because in 79, and when I was out doing that show, I was standing on the stage of the Academy of Music in Philadelphia with Richard Kiley, and he was singing Dulcinea to the character, my character, and I'm on stage, and I absolutely remember thinking to myself, it's never going to get any better than this, never. And it never really did, and I knew that right then. It's like I found a part, and it was mine, and I was good at it, and there it was with Richard Kiley, whom everybody idolized. And you know, when I first saw La Mancha when I was in high school, I remember thinking, one of these days I'm going to do that part with that man. And there it was all those years later, and I knew it wasn't going to get any better than that. And then the music started to change, so, and I didn't change with it, so then it turned into something else.
To dream the impossible dream. Susan, you and I could go on the road. We could resurrect it, okay?
Yeah, I think I'm a little over the hill for Aldonza now. Yeah.
I'll carry you.
Oh, okay. All right, that's a good idea.
We'll get a bus ride to Toledo. All right, we're talking to Susan Wellman, who has performed, sung the national anthem before many New York Yankee games.
Well, also, I mean, thousands of games. And you know why I did that? And this is really interesting. In the 70s, I started singing the national anthem in the 70s when I was out with Man of La Mancha, because Richard Kiley did not do matinees. And when you're on the road with something, you know, you're by yourself all the time. And I would go and I would call up wherever I was, Minnesota, for example. This was the old ballpark in Bloomington, wasn't even the Dome, 79. And I was still in theater, so I was still a Red Sox fan. And the Red Sox were in Minneapolis when we were doing La Mancha. And I called up the stadium, and I asked for the PR director, and I said, hi, my name is Susan Waldman, and I'm starring in Man of La Mancha. Do you need an anthem singer? And that was usually met with dead silence, because nobody had realized it was a way to get on television. I just want to go to the ball game. And people got very excited, and I sang Minneapolis, Toronto. I mean, every place. I sang the anthem all over the place. Sang in the 79 playoffs. We were in Pittsburgh. That's the We Are Family game team. And we were there for 2 months in Pittsburgh at this gorgeous old Stanley Theater. And I would go and sing the anthem on Wednesday and Saturday afternoons, you know, and go, because I wanted to go to the ball game. And I ended up singing in the playoffs, and I sang in the, I used to sing opening day at Fenway Park for years. So it wasn't just the Yankees. I sang all over the place because I wanted to go to the ball game, and they picked me up and they gave me lunch and they let me talk with players, and I got to go for free. So that was what that was. So that was my way of staying with sports. And I got to tell you, a lot of this started because Richard Kiley did not like to get up and go on, you know, Good Morning Miami, Good Morning Toronto, Good Morning Pittsburgh. He didn't want to get up. So I would get up. And eventually it was after I talked about the show for 5 minutes, we talked about whatever sports teams were in town. And eventually it was when we got into a city, it was always get the girl who talks about sports after she sells the show. And that was how all that started, too. I mean, that was just it's all an accident, because there was no way to do anything. And things just happened. And you just sort of have to roll with the punches and go where life takes you.
We're talking to Susan Wallman. After 15 years, she walked away from musical theater, and the world's never been the same. We'll talk about that next chapter when we come back. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula with Susan Wallman. Since 2005, she's been the color commentator for the New York Yankees radio broadcasts. All right, 1987, Susan. You're the first voice on WFAN when it becomes the first all-sports radio station in America. You changed the world. How'd you ever get that gig?
Oh, boy. I was wondering what you were going to ask about that. How I got that gig was the man who put this together was a wonderful man named John Channon. And he was really good friends with the late play-by-play broadcaster of the Boston Red Sox named Ken Coleman. And Kenny had told me in 1986, you know, I had started moving away from theater in 79. The music was changing. There was an epiphany I had when I auditioned for Evita in 1979. And in 87 is years later. So I was still working. I was still did clubs, and I still did a couple of shows. My last show was a musical called Nine. And meanwhile, I was thinking about what I was going to do. And Ken Coleman had said, you know, you should listen to what the players were saying to you. When I would sing the anthem, I would sit in the dugout with guys. And one day, and this is a great story, Jack, because the man who was who said this is, I saw him that day. I'd never met him before, and I've never seen him since. I was sitting in a dugout. I was before I sang the anthem, the Red Sox-Minnesota game in Minnesota, and I was talking to Jim Rice, and it was the year after he had won the MVP, or it was 79. So 78 had that great year. And we were just talking about hitting, and he had said to me, you know, I haven't seen a fastball all year, and this was in May already. And I said, so you're hitting 315 by accident is what you're telling me. And he started laughing. We started talking about the team and everything. And there was a guy doing the game with Joe Garagiola, and his name was Wes Parker, and he used to be the first baseman for the Dodgers. And he had gone to see me do La Mancha with a bunch of the other guys the night before and wanted to talk to me about acting, because when he retired from baseball, he was doing broadcasting, and he did some acting. So he wanted to talk to me, and when I turned around and saw him there, he said, have you ever thought of doing this for a living? And I said, doing what for a living? And he said, well, the way you just talked to Jim Rice and the way he was talking to you, you could do this for a living. And I said, yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I didn't know what he was talking about. So that was all planted in my head. So this is years later when Kenny tells me that there is this WFAN that's going to go on the air, and WFAN, and he calls the general manager and said, you have to meet this woman. I mean, she's funny, and she's sarcastic, and she never stops talking, and she knows everything about everything. And so I called him, and he said, can you get me a tape? I said, oh, sure, I can get you a tape. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I did know someone who worked in radio, And I went in to somebody's overnight gig, and after he was done, we put together, he showed me what a tape was, and we did a phony sportscast, and being smart alecky and all that. And I took the little cassette, and I put it on the guy's desk the next day, and they thought it would be a good idea if I played off a guy who was going to do afternoon drive, and his name was Pete Franklin, and he was out of Cleveland. And they thought it would be funny to have this, you know, sort of sarcastic girl doing updates with this very acerbic sports talk guy. It didn't happen because he, you know, he got sick and he wasn't there for a while. But so they hired me. I had no idea what I was doing, and I got there. And once I got there, Jack, within 2 seconds, when I could hear people yelling that, you know, get that girl with the Boston accent off my air, it became something else, because I hadn't realized that women weren't and still really aren't wanted in this business. So then it, you know, I was old enough that I wasn't going to let anybody push me, you know, push me out of this business. And I saw, you know, all that there was a reason why I thought I could do it, because I never saw any women. And then within that first day or two, I realized why I didn't see any women. And that was something, then it changed, and I wanted to do something else, you know, become something else. I wasn't going to let other generations go through what I eventually went through doing this job.
2005, you're hired to do color commentary for Yankee baseball radio games with John Sterling. So you meet the legendary George Steinbrenner, the boss.
George Steinbrenner, except for my mother and my grandfather, is the most important person in my life. And I met him in 87. And 80, when I started in this and covered my first Yankee game. And in 1988, he'd said to me, Waldman, one of these days I am going to make a statement about women in sports. You're it, and I hope you can take it. And this is 1988, and I didn't know what he was talking about back then. But after the things that happened to me and the death threats, and I had my own police detail for a solid year, Yankee Stadium, 1989, because people were trying to kill me. Because I was talking about baseball on the radio. You know, George treated me, George pushed me a lot. George, I was on the other end of those phone calls, too. Let's put it that. He, you know, he's very mercurial, but he was extremely important to me. I would not be here without George Steinbrenner, because he was going to make a statement, and he was wanted to make sure that he picked the right person, someone who wasn't going to quit, someone who wouldn't be afraid to say they were wrong and learn, and someone who would keep going. But he's, you know, the third most important person in my life is George Steinbrenner.
All right. I believe you once said that the most memorable moment while covering the Yankees was when you brought Yogi Berra and George Steinbrenner back together again. Talk about that.
I did. That was kind of a... it turned out to be like my thank you to the Yankees, because for all those years, I had never met Yogi Berra. I think I met him at Mel Allen's funeral once, Phil Rizzuto, who is another wonderful human being. Phil Rizzuto introduced me. I'd never met him. He was never, you know, at the games. I was, you know, he got fired in, what, 84, and I started in 87. I'd never met him. I'd seen him, obviously. My father used to tell me he never saw Yogi Berra make an out at Fenway Park. So I obviously knew him, and I knew his granddaughter, but I never had met Yogi. And Yogi was starting a museum, and the program director at WFAN at the time, Mark Chernoff, had called me and said, we're doing a show at Yogi Berra's brand new museum. You're hosting it from 6 to 9, and they're going to have some of the 73 Mets on, and wouldn't it be great if you could bring George and Yogi back together? Because people had tried, Jack, for years. I mean, everybody had tried. And Yogi would said no, and George would say no, and it never worked out. And about a week afterwards, after we were going to do this, I was talking about George about something, and I said, George, I want to talk to you about Yogi. And George said, why, what's wrong? And as soon as he said, what's wrong, I figured this might be an opening. So I made the suggestion, why don't you know, it's been a long time. Let's make this up. And well, we'll do it in spring training. No, it has to be here, and it has to be on this date, and it has to be in New Jersey at Yogi's Museum. Well, you work it out. What does he want? And I said, he wants you to apologize. And he said, well, what does he want me to apologize for? And I said, I don't know, George. I wasn't there. You know. I negotiated with Dale Berra, Yogi's son. Mm-hmm. I never talked to Yogi. Mm-hmm. And, of course, my loyalty was with George. And George, for some reason, I guess he was feeling older and he thought it was time. And a lot of his friends were getting sick. And I think he wanted this over. And he agreed to fly to New Jersey and, you know, and talk to Yogi. And if it worked, they would be on the air. And that is one tape that I still have, is my introducing that show and saying, Mr. Berra, you remember Mr. Steinbrenner. Mr. Steinbrenner, you remember Mr. Berra. And we put it together, and Dale Berra and I negotiated everything, and we weren't allowed to tell anybody, just in case it didn't work. I mean, they could have gone into a room and started screaming at each other, which they did, by the way, until Carmen Berra, Yogi's wife, went into the room, and then they all came out and whatever it was. And it turned out Yogi was not mad that he was fired. He was mad that George didn't do it himself because he thought he deserved that. And that's why he was angry all those years. But it turned into the most unbelievable. I had everything all set up to go in case it worked. You know, I had Joe Garagiola was going to be on, and Ted Williams was going to be on, and Bill White was going to be on, and they were all there, and they were all, you know, on the phone lines waiting to go on. And, you know, if it didn't work, I was going to be stuck with Yogi and the 73 Mets for the next 3 hours. But it was quite something. And and Jack, I got to tell you, because you can picture this, is that I was doing it in an empty auditorium. It was Yogi, me, and George at one table, and an empty auditorium, because no one was allowed to know. Nobody knew that this was going to happen. And within 5-10 minutes after the three voices hit the air, me, George, and Yogi, doors kept opening, and people were running in, people from the train station, coming back from the gym. And by the time there was 20 minutes into the show, the place was packed with just fans just wanting to be in this museum and being there with George and Yogi today, so that day. And, yeah, that was my thank you to George and my thank you for the Yankees for this actually incredible career.
We're talking to Susan Wellman. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, with Susan Wellman. We want to talk to her about a couple of her favorite all-time athletes. First, number one. Teddy Ballgame, the Kid, the Splendid Splinter, the Thumper. The great Ted Williams, your number one athlete. Why?
Only hero, sports hero I ever had, Ted Williams. Well, I don't remember saying this, but I am told that when I first saw Ted Williams, now don't forget, I was a little girl, and I was sitting in the front row of Fenway Park, next to the Red Sox dugout, and there was the on deck circle back then was right by the fence, so you could actually, I literally could reach out and touch that man. And I am told that I said to my grandfather, "Who is that man?" when I first saw him. He had just come back from Korea, and I said, "Who is that man?" And my grandfather said, "That's Ted Williams." Why? And I am told that I said, "If God is a person, that's what he looks like." But it wasn't what he looked like necessarily. It was what he did. Teddy took a lot of guff from writers and people and things. And he only got better. He never complained. He never said anything. There was one writer that was after him for years, and he just got better. And there was something about his whole personality that you just keep going. You get better and better and better. And you don't, you know, you can complain by yourself, but you don't do it in the papers, and you don't do it to fans. You just get better. There was just something about him. And he was John Wayne. And I knew him when I was 4, and I knew him when I was 34 and 44, and he never changed, never. And you know how you always say, please don't let me meet my childhood idols because I don't want to be disappointed. I was never disappointed with Ted Williams. He was larger than life. I thought he was warm, and he was the best that there was. And if there was somebody that was going to be better, he was going to keep working to make sure that he was better. And it was it's just that whole thing, the whole presence, the whole he carried his own star with him, Jack. I don't know how to put it any more than that. But it was just something about that getting better. You don't give in to people. You don't give in to what anybody says about you. You know who you are.
People that when he walked down the street said, there goes the greatest hitter who ever lived. He was like the real, the natural, the movie Natural with the Robert Redford
yep.
one year.
Yep.
Ted Williams was like that for 15-plus years.
So. He really was. And just think if those 5 years that he lost his best 5 years to two wars. The man went into two wars. His best 5 years. Bob Feller once said to me when I met Bob Feller, because Teddy had told me that the only pitcher that he really feared was Bob Feller. And I did get to meet Bob Feller in Cleveland. I went and I introduced myself to him, and he said that he's the one who had said to me, and he told me something that I didn't realize. Never mind the 5 years, Jack, that Ted Williams lost to two different wars. Don't forget the sacrifice fly was not there when he was playing. So he hit 341 lifetime without a sacrifice fly. You got charged for an at-bat for a sac fly. How many runs did they? They weren't all home runs. They were fly balls that he did to get runs in, and he still hit 341 lifetime. I mean, that's extraordinary. Think of the difference back then and what he did. But Feller, because Teddy hated Feller's curveball. He thought that was the best pitch he'd ever seen, and he couldn't do it. And Feller kind of laughed at it, and he said, well, you know, that's the only pitch that anyone could ever get anything and get Teddy out with. But he was as good as it got, I think, to this day.
I think there was 1 year he was batting 400.001 or something with the last day was a doubleheader. Right?
And then he ended up batting 406 because he wouldn't see. That's what it is. I know a lot of batting champs that sat their last day to keep the 300 or keep that. Teddy didn't. He played it was 399 point. It would have been rounded off to 400, but he wouldn't sit. He played the two games of the doubleheader and ended up batting 406 for that year.
All right, another one.
Yeah.
You've said, I quote you, my favorite Yankee of all time is Donnie Ballgame, Don Mattingly. Why?
Donnie Baseball. Because when I came into this game, he was there. I wasn't treated all that well. But not by the Yankees. I'm not talking about the Yankees. But he was the captain, and there was something about Don Mattingly that he was every man. He was the kind of ball player. You know, there are a lot of ball players that you look at and you say, I can't do that. Everybody thought if they had worked a little harder or didn't have to do this or didn't, everybody thought they were Don Mattingly or they could have been Don Mattingly. He was approachable. There wasn't anybody who didn't love him. He was everybody's hero. He was the blue-collar worker who came in and took New York by storm. He worked all the time. You never saw him without a bat in his hand, working on the working on his stance, working on his swing. He was as good a first baseman as I've ever seen. He was just something about him. And when I started, Jack, in 1987, and he doesn't know it. He knows I like him very much, and he knows that. But he never knew what he meant to me, because there were a lot of times in that year when I was treated really badly, and he'd just say something, not in the Yankees, but around, and he'd say something about, you know, what I heard what you said yesterday. That was good. It's a great point. Let's talk about that. Or he'd say something that would just get me out of this sort of self-pitying mood, and I can't do this. And it never stopped. It never stopped. And when he retired after 95, I got to tell you, when we were all coming back from Seattle on that plane, when we got beaten by Seattle in the wild card game in the last game, Donnie was going up. It was the worst 6 hours I ever had in my life. And Donnie was going up and down the plane saying goodbye to everybody. And in 96, when he wasn't there, I couldn't walk by his locker without crying. I couldn't walk by that locker because he wasn't there. And I had never been in that clubhouse without Don Mattingly. And if you talk to people about Donnie, he made other people. He made Bernie Williams into Bernie Williams. You know, he told him, you can do this. Don't listen to these guys. They used to pick on Bernie. And Donnie, very quietly, you never saw it. But if you walked around, once a rookie named Pat Kelly, who was a young second baseman, and I walked into the clubhouse one day, and he was watching Donnie put on his uniform. And I went over, and I said, Patty, what are you doing? And he said, I'm watching Don put on the uniform. And I said, why? And he said, I want to do it right. And I know if I watch him, I'll do it right. I mean, he had an extraordinary effect on everybody. Humble, blue collar. You know, the picture of the little boy's probably grown up by now. There's a picture where he makes a catch of a foul ball and takes popcorn out of a little boy's container and eats it and ruffles his hair. I mean, that's Don Mattingly. It's just he was and still is. He's an extraordinary human being.
We're talking to Susan Wellman. Back on June 29th and 30th, 2019, she called the first Major League Baseball game played in Europe in London's Wembley Stadium. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist, who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to a pioneer who's beginning his 37th season covering broadcasting for the New York Yankees. All right. Ted Williams said Bob Feller's curveball was the greatest pitch he ever saw. The greatest reliever of all time is Mariano Rivera. Not a big man. Basically had one pitch. Everybody knew what was coming. Nobody could hit it. And, Susan, no other pitcher could throw it. How?
Well, they can throw it. They just can't get the same results. And when I met Mariano, Jack, he was a starter. He had all four pitches. And one day he was fooling around in the backfield. He was still in the minors. He had had an operation. I can't remember whether it was shoulder or elbow. I can't remember. But he had an operation, and he was coming back, and he was fooling around with Tony Cloninger was a pitching coach in the minor leagues, and he was out on the fields. And I'll tell you this, and I don't think people know this. He was out there working with Whitey Ford and Ron Guidry. And they were out there, and Mariano was fooling around with this pitch. And Whitey said to Guidry, you catch him. I'm too old for this. I can't do it. He couldn't catch it. And so he kept in it. Just the movement was just so erratic. But if you look at the pitch, and they've tried to break it down for years, it was just pressure on different points. It would move, and you could. It was like Michael Jordan, who could say, I'm going to cut right, and I'm going to come left, and I'm going to come around, and I'm going to post up, and I'm going to dunk. And you would know it was coming, and you couldn't stop it. And, you know, familiarity bred contempt, I think. And, you know, the Red Sox that 1 year in 2004 got him. But don't forget, Jack, he was the greatest reliever of all time. 17 years. Who does that? With one pitch. And it was different pressure points and a heart as big as a lion. He was another one that was not going to be stopped. he was going to be the best there was, no matter what. He'd have one little spot every single year where he'd give up three or four saves in a row, and everybody would say, he's not throwing his heart, and, you know, when he's done, and he never was. And the greatest thing about Mariano was he was going to retire one year, and we were in Kansas City, and he was shagging balls in the outfield, and he tore up his knee, and he missed the whole season, and he wasn't going to go out that way. So he came back the next year so that he could show himself, and then he had a great year. And then he said, that's it. I can't do it anymore. But Mariano, by the way, was probably the best athlete on the field at all times. Bernie said he was the best center fielder he'd ever seen. Jeter said he was the best shortstop he'd ever seen. So he was quite the athlete. He was an extraordinary man and still is, absolutely still is.
Okay. Back in 2022, Spike Lee, Michael Tollin, are executive producers of the series, the seven-part series, The Captain.
Mm.
Derek Jeter. Talk about Derek Jeter.
The best thing, the most thing I remember most, he was the same person, Jack, when I met him at 18, as when he walked out the door over 20 years later. He knew who he was from the beginning. And if you spend 5 minutes with his parents, you know why. He is an extraordinary man. Just think about this. He played in New York for 20 years, the biggest media capital in the world. Never said anything wrong, ever, ever. It was never plastered on the front pages or the back pages. Jeter blasts somebody. Jeter says this. Never for 20 years. How is that possible in New York? Extraordinary man. Also not born. He had one thing in common with Don Mattingly, is that he worked at everything. He would do a little thing every winter to get better. He'd work on one thing, whether it was a jump throw. He didn't have that when I first saw him. And all of a sudden, this will work. And then go the Jeterian swing, as John Sterling likes to call it. He didn't come out of the womb doing that. He learned to go the other way because they were jamming him inside. So I'm going to learn to do this. He learned. He got better and better and better every single year. Best clutch player, Jack, I think I've ever seen. And look at his numbers in the postseason. And all those postseasons, he played an entire season worth of postseason games. And look at those numbers. And look at the RBIs. And look at the plays he made. Extraordinary man. Same kind of captain as was Don Mattingly. Very quiet. Talked to people. A little different sense of humor. But talked to people. Never around the press. Never, never, ever did we see him talk to a player if something was wrong. It was always in the back. But you'd say, well, Jeets told me to do this, or Jeets told me that. And, you know, Derek said, if I try this, it might work.
We're talking to Susan Waldman, who keeps getting better and better and better. Susan, thanks a million for doing this. It's been an honor.
Thank you so much for asking me, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.